It's Wednesday, May 27th, 2009, and you're listening to episode 149 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 8 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
And according to my mug, my name is Chad.
I'm Pat.
And I'm just Chris.
And you know, Chad, I appreciate it because you got your mug down to the last inch or two of cider there. Mm-hmm. And unlike Pat, you haven't dumped it on my floor. And Pat's, his thing even has a lid. And he manages to dump his Mountain Dew all over my floor.
Yes. At least he didn't dump it all over the recording equipment.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, come on. Actually, you provided more wetness to the carpet than I did. The carpet kept it up there, and I cleaned it all off, and you come in here with the steam thing. It's still wet over here now.
This mug amazes me, really, because I have a mug in Dan's house that is, in Pack and Verify, has my name on it.
It does.
It's a glass mug with a pewter piece glued to it and engraved with my name. I got it because I was in a friend's wedding. I was.
I have one of those, too.
Yep, I was part of the wedding, and all this night I got personalized ones. And for some reason, I left it at Dan's house 8 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that. Many, many moons ago. This has been in every single home that Dan has lived in, even when we were arguing and we weren't talking for 5 years. And it even moved with him. And I opened the countertop, the thing today. I'm like, I need a mug. And I'm like, there's a mug in this house with my name on it. And I found it and I got it. And
it's a nice mug.
It is a nice mug. And it there's just something really sweet about knowing that there's always a mug at my best friend's house with my name on
it. That's right.
Literally.
Yeah. It's kind of like somebody says, you know, there's always couch space here if you need it. It's that kind of thing as well. That, you know, there's always a mug here if you need it.
Yeah.
So you always feel welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of always feeling welcome, if you're going to Gen Con this year, feartheboot.com/GenCon. Don't forget to get signed up for that.
We are
going
to have a gorilla panel. Just need to, you know, plan that.
And find four gorillas.
And four gorillas, yeah.
But it's going to be pretty cool. Also, episode 150. I don't know if that's... I
dun,
guess it's,
dun, dun.
Was it sesquicentennial or whatever that's called?
Yes, sesquicentennial.
Yeah, here you go. There's the
Sasquatch Centennial, yes.
Mm. Yeah. But we are going to do something a little bit special in 150, which
a is... A little bit? This isn't a little bit special. This is earth-shattering. This is epic.
No, this is earth-shaking.
It is earth-shaking. This is easily the most epic thing we've done since the last epic thing we've done.
Oh, and speaking of which, happy 3-year anniversary to Fear the Boot of about 2 weeks ago, because that would have been May 15th. So
3 years of almost continuous episodes.
Yeah. It's like the longest dump anyone's ever taken.
Indeed.
But you guys will be pleased to know that as of episode 150, while he himself has retired from the fight, Don Shadowrun is bringing back the Shadowrun League with the Rifts League thoroughly defeated. He is ready to take on the Dark Lord of Denny's, who will be leading the Denny's League in the Power 16-2. There will be some of them...
An epic struggle.
There are going to be some favorites that did really well in the previous one that will be back for round two.
And Don Shadowrun is a merciless, heartless man. He has made cuts to his team. And he has gotten new, fresh blood to take on this new challenge.
He has also reached into his deep pockets, swollen with the blood money of a hideous game, which he has used to even buy some of the players off of the now defunct and bankrupted Rifts League.
Yes.
And has brought them over to his side. Others,
wow. That dude is an evil bastard.
He is.
He is an evil bastard.
Others that are just looking for revenge. But now the Rifts League is gone, don't have it anymore, have joined the Dark Lord of Denny's to take on Don Shadowrun and try and stop his tyrannical rampage. Folks, this is like WWE Raw, except it matters and it's real.
That's right.
Don Shadowrun is a real man, all right?
He is. And he's out there and he wrote Shadowrun.
That's right. In fact, it's named after him. And they are coming back in the Power 16-2, which will kick off in episode 150 with the first brackets of voting. So you guys better be ready because the fate of the world hangs
on
this.
It does. It does. Don Shadowrun is like, Well, I can't even describe it. I'm so excited about this.
Picking the winner of the Power 16 is like if we could actually vote for like the head of the UN.
Yes.
Except this organization does more than talk.
It does.
They it has actual there, authority.
They it does. Ruin your games.
Indeed.
And it's up to you to decide who you want to ruin your games. In the Power 16 one, it came down to an epic fight between Batman and Baron von Badass. And
I remember those days, man. Each time the bracket moved in and bracket moved down, we could not predict the winner. We had no clue who the winner would be of each individual fight. They were so close. It was amazing.
And Baron von Badass won.
He did.
I think he rightfully won. Cheated.
I am almost sure of it.
I mean, it's like it was the Ennies.
Yeah.
I mean, he just got in there and voted for himself however many times he pleased. And we did read the results fairly and honestly. We didn't manipulate the voting, but, you know, there are some similarities. Yeah. And so that is coming.
Wow. Wow.
Feartheboot.com/GenCon if you want more of this. All right. So the banter topic for this episode was suggested by Pat.
Uh-oh.
Whoa.
And I have no idea what there is to even talk about here. So, Pat, I'm giving you the wheel here.
Uh-oh.
This is a dangerous thing.
This comes right back to player trust. Is their host moderator trust?
Yeah, that's about the same as like letting me bake.
He's about to learn a very hard lesson.
I do have to say that I've had Dan's cooking. You should never eat Dan's cooking.
I can do grilled cheese and eggs.
I'm sorry, Dan. Anyone can do grilled cheese and eggs.
But I can do them better than any human being alive.
You remind me of the Charlie Brown Thanksgiving where all you can make is cereal and toast.
Mm-hmm, yeah, except the toast glows and the cereal cures cancer.
Chris, you remind me of the last floater I had. But
when did Chris have corn?
I live in Iowa, dude. I always have corn.
Cornholing. Whoa.
But you wanted to talk about television ratings and show cancellation?
I did.
I'm actually really interested in this topic.
I don't know where he's going with this is the thing.
Well, we were talking about this, and it actually...
This is like somebody walks into your house and says, so me and your daughter, and then pauses.
And you went out for ice cream.
Yeah, and you're like, where is this going? So, all right, Pat, ratings and cancellations.
It sort of stemmed from our banter topic from the last episode. I sort of flowed into that. We were talking about, you know, reviewing of movies and whatever like that. And we started talking about the television shows and along those lines and ratings. And it started in a discussion about Dollhouse, the fact that it is, I believe it may very well be the lowest rated show that is ever.
I have heard I cannot substantiate this. Yeah, this is hearsay, but I have heard a quote unquote fact that Dollhouse was the lowest rated show in the history of television to get picked up for a second season.
Right.
I don't know if that's true or not.
And you said part of the reason for that is what they did was originally they were looking at like the, you know, DVR. Originally they look at like the night ratings, and then they expanded that like to for 3 days for like the DVR crowd.
Yeah.
That is an ever expanding market. And then they further looked at and they expanded that out to like 5 more days to catch like the weekend traffic.
Well, now
that
they got like more people. Hulu and
Here's what I was told is that with Dollhouse, the Nielsen ratings, the Nielsen families rate them really low. They pulled the DVR data, and the understanding is that on DVR data, they only pull 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So they extended that out to 5 days, which hit up upon a weekend, and they found that a bunch of people were watching it on the weekend. This gave them the theory, the network execs, that while people don't love this show, they kind of like it, so they won't watch it when it comes out because they don't care, but they like it enough to where they'll eventually get around to watching it. They looked at the website data off Hulu and off whatever channel it's on, their website if they play it. They looked at that data and found generally the same supporting evidence was true.
Yeah.
You know what this, not your specific comment, but what this...
And I don't know if any of this is true, by the way. This is all...
Right. But you know what this whole thing in general reminds me of, you guys talking about them pushing out the days, is, of course, within movies, there's this whole waving thing about who has the biggest opening weekend.
Right.
And so as a strategy to change that, movies started coming out on Thursday or Wednesday
right.
or whatever. And now all of a sudden the opening weekend is actually 2 days longer than what it would have been as a way of, you know, making that so statistically.
And the
better.
Other thing about that is I've always laughed at that because it's all moot, because if you try to say that a movie 5 years ago made $50 million and then it was beat by a movie this year that made $51 million, I'm like, that means nothing, because 5 years of inflation trumps $1 million.
You know,
and well, those are not the right numbers. You're talking hundreds, like $600 million.
Back.
Have you guys heard of a movie called Cutthroat Island? It was a pirate movie.
Are you kidding? I love that movie.
Oh, yeah, I've sick man. Actually, I've never seen it.
I have the DVD and the soundtrack.
Is it the one with...
It was the largest flop in...
Yeah, that's the... what's her name? Gina Davis.
Yeah. Rennie Harlan directed
it. More or less ended her career for a while. Pretty much this movie cost almost $100 million to make.
Wow.
And its foreign and domestic gross, $10 million.
Oh, ouch.
Hollywood was not able to make, or was too afraid to make, a pirate movie until Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
It was one of the largest flops in recent time. It was just horrible.
Yeah, because I think the largest flop, I think, was Pluto Nash, the Eddie Murphy sci-fi comedy actioner.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah, and that one made, I may have made even less. I know it had a terrible opening. But, you know, Dan, speaking of the opening weekend, and I think the reason why there's such emphasis on things like that is because, if I'm getting the statistics pulled out of my ass correctly, I believe movies make roughly 50% of, you know, their, you know, final gross in that opening weekend. Then it all just drops off from there.
Yeah.
So what was the original?
Well, and I want to pull us back to ratings for television shows and the, you know, this is about watching television, because, you know, television it's a fairly big thing for us. I think for gamers as well. There's a lot of shows out there that we like to watch.
TV is popular.
But I am a TiVo/DVR person. And I have been for some time now. And I think that I am typical when I say that when you get TiVo or a DVR, at that point, you sort of look at it like, I cannot believe I waited so long to get this. Hmm. I can't believe that I ever watched live television. And that's the way I term it. I never watch live television anymore. In fact, I loathe to watch live television. I hate it with a passion. I tremble, and I get like the shakes, the withdrawal shakes, when I have to sit through the commercials and I can't fast forward them because it's live.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, what I mean by that is I don't have any concept anymore of when the hell a show is on, what night it's on. I couldn't tell you what's on Monday nights because I have season passes for everything. I don't watch it whenever it's on. I don't watch it when it's immediately recorded. I watch it at some point in the future. Part of that is because of my schedule, whatever. But I just don't know when they're on, other than the fact that I recorded it.
Hmm.
And what that's done is you still have the bulk of ratings, you know, Nielsen, whoever else, that are looking at the immediate vicinity around when a show aired.
Right.
And granted, it used to be that, you know, the TiVo, you know, people, it was a small part of the population, but I think that's gotten bigger and bigger, and it's going to continue to get bigger, I think, because it's an incredible way to watch television on your own terms. But they're still focusing too much on the fact that it has to be immediately like what's on there here and now. My conjecture was that needs to change, and they need to expand that out and basically look at the, you know, the people that are watching it, a recorded DVR instead. Like right now on my DVR at home, I've got probably 4 or 5 episodes of a given show that I haven't watched yet because I just haven't gotten around to it. And I'll get some time. I'll sit down for a 2 or 3 hour period of time and watch just an episode after another and, you know, catch up that way. I like to do that.
Let me ask you a question here, Pat, because is ultimately that information you're giving, in a sense, almost useless to the networks? And here's why I say that. Because as a fellow pure DVR consumer, what you and I both do, I mean, sometimes I'll watch History Channel in the background while I'm programming or something. But the shows I follow, like House or things like that, I DVR them and fast forward through the commercials. Well, obviously, the way the networks make their money is by selling ad space.
Yes.
And if people like you and I aren't watching the ads, then ultimately isn't what they really need to do for their sake is put on shows that are doing well as appointment television, because even if 100 times as many people will DVR them, but then don't bother watching the commercials, those commercial slots become worthless. And as a result, for their model to survive, assuming they don't change the entire model, which I think they need to do.
And that's where I'm going to go.
But for their model to survive, it would not matter if 20 million people watch a show on DVR. They'd be better off putting on a show that 1 million people will actually watch on appointment and see the commercials.
Yeah, it's a very valid point, but I think you already said what the problem is with it. That's the archaic. That's the past. It's the dinosaur model, and it's changing. It's the technology. I mean, this is the way of things. This is the way we're going, and you've got to change that model. You've got to figure out what's going to work, and they've already started to do it. You're starting to see more product placement back into shows because they realize, oh, crap, all these people are getting DVRs, and why are they doing it? Because they don't like to watch the damn commercials. That's a detriment to commercial television, where that's how they make their money. But you're going to have to figure out a way to change that industry and do it. I think as a stopgap, until they figure out exactly what to do, yes, you're right. They still want to look at the people that watch appointment television, but that's not where it really is anymore. It's, you know, you're going to have to figure out how to change, what to do. I don't have the answer, obviously, but somebody's going to have to come up with it and figure it out.
All right, Chris, now that the experts have spoken, go ahead and conjecture wildly about television like you know anything about it.
Yeah,
I'll just throw some out there and see what sticks.
Hey, Chris, just for the viewers at home, what is your profession again?
I am a marketing manager at a local NBC affiliate television station.
Cool. All right, go.
Hey, do you have a DVR?
I do not have a DVR, nor do I have cable or satellite.
He has a photon torpedo, though.
Wow, he only watches the local television.
Get this. I do not own a DVR. I have neither cable nor satellite.
Yeah. Cool.
And I only watch one TV show. I watch Heroes, and I don't watch Heroes on the network. I watch Heroes on Netflix a couple of days after it comes out, and I watch it streaming over the internet with no commercials.
And there, with what Chad just said, is one of the things why I want to poke one hole in your general theory and what you're talking about there, Pat, is why, and even though I think DVR penetration is still pretty good,
It is the best. It's not just good.
I don't think it's going to grow to the extent that you're thinking it might, primarily because of things like Netflix and definitely because of things like Hulu, because I don't watch...
He's poking holes, he's penetrating, he's growing.
Best episode ever.
I haven't gotten to the throbbing portion yet.
Don't you guys censor this kind of crap on your local affiliates? I mean, come on.
I don't watch... There's very little appointment television. My favorite show at 24... Haven't watched an episode of it on TV when it was on all season long. I basically watch it the day after on Hulu because it's in a format that I prefer, because I don't mind the little 30-second interruptions that occur every 10 minutes or so. And general research has shown that most people really don't. As long as it's free to them, they don't mind those minor interruptions like that. Yeah, granted, your 3.5-minute commercial breaks, that's one thing. But a 30-second break in between there... not bad. It's tolerable.
I absolutely agree with you, because in the times, I don't watch it very often, but when I have watched the Hulu, the 30-second break, I think there's like four of them maybe in an episode. Absolutely tolerable for 30 seconds, but you're right. It's the 3.5 minutes that it just pisses me off. I'm sorry. Continue, please.
It's the broadband technology is what needs to continue to improve so that those programs can come down in HD, as they were meant to be seen, or as they're being broadcast now. That matters. And I do agree with you that in general, Nielsen, I can't really speak to the ratings and how they work in the larger markets and with networks and with the overnights and what, because I haven't had any personal experience with that. But when you get into doing the ratings in other markets, the science behind it is not the most sound science, because you're relying on people to fill out books and write down what they watched and when they watched it. And knowing how people behave, that's very difficult to trust. Because most people will fill things out at the last minute. It's like doing your homework in high school. You do it at the last minute. Same thing with the ratings book. People will get that and they'll fill it out like the day before they have to send it back in, and just guessing based upon what they normally watch. Not everybody does that, but some people do.
Chris, if I interrupt you, I knew someone who actually, and I don't know if it was Nielsen or who it was. I think it was Nielsen, who got paid... it was a couple bucks a month or something.
You get paid $5. Yeah.
Well, right. But they didn't give him a book. They hooked a box up to his TV.
And those are the overnight markets. Now, St. Louis is probably what's called a metered market, meaning that they can get those ratings results damn near instantly. In market, in like the size of town I live, you're in what's called a diary market, and that's where you have that book you got to fill out. The meters and the boxes like you're talking about are not nationwide. In the big cities, yes. Smaller towns, mid and smaller towns, no. Although that, too, will be changing a couple years down the road. But it is very difficult now with the way technology has changed and with what DVRs have done and what the internet is doing to gauge where and how exactly people watch. And I think that it's, in a certain way, though I have not watched Dollhouse, and am I likely to? Probably not. But it's very smart of them to look at the show the way they looked at it and make their decision to keep it, I think, if what Chad says is true, because that just shows a more thorough analysis of the data and how people truly view things. And I think there's probably other shows that may have been in that same boat, but they just didn't benefit from that foresight.
That was where that's kind of why I wanted to talk about this in the first place, is that there have been countless shows in the past years that they've come out. I've been excited about them. I've wanted to see them. And they'll come out and they literally will get one airing, maybe two airings, before they would, you know, the network would cancel them. And I just don't think you can get a fair representation of what a show is going to be like in two episodes.
No way.
Because, well, and they always bring out the classic, you know, examples of two of the most popular shows in existence. I think MASH and Seinfeld had horrible ratings in their first, even maybe the season, but then they went on to be the juggernauts that they were. It's always just so subjective. And like you said, I think, you know, the whole point that they use these, like the diaries where people just sort of do it as a last minute thing to do that or whatever, to make these, you know, slashing decisions on shows. And also, I think, you know, certainly recently, it's a shotgun approach of they just throw all this crap against the wall and see what sticks. And a lot of it is crap. But some, I think a fair number of really potentially good shows have, you know, been axed and not even given a chance.
Family Guy is a perfect example of that, of a show that was dropped by Fox because it didn't meet their ratings muster. And then it goes on to have this great life on Adult Swim. And then, of course, then the DVD sales come out and it goes through the roof. And suddenly they realize, well, wait a second, this show may actually be a much better show. We need to give it a second chance.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're exactly right. But this other side of that sword is, it comes back to the whole commercials and making money, because selling commercials is how networks make their money. If the show's not generating the ratings, they can't generate the revenue. It can't exist. You have pressures on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's something like, for example, with Jericho.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Tons of people watch it on DVD or over Netflix, but that doesn't make any ratings for the network. Now, the question is, can we reach a point where you can have TV shows like movies that are straight to DVD that sell enough to actually get a following? And I don't know. Chris, I have a question for you before we close this topic out and get back to role-playing games.
Shoot!
Which is something that has been nagging on my mind for years, because it feels to be true, but I'm not clear if it actually is true. I know TV shows have a standardized length. Are commercial breaks actually getting longer and TV shows actually getting shorter than, say, 20, 30 years ago?
I believe that is correct. It varies from network to network. I remember seeing a stat one time saying the average network TV break was 2.5 to 3 minutes long. And these stats are a few years ago, but the average break on MTV was over 5 minutes long. And I think that kind of pattern still holds true today. And actually, you can kind of gauge this. If you look at a network show on Hulu, the actual length of that show averages anywhere between 40 and 45 minutes. So obviously math tells you you've got between 15 and 20 minutes of commercial time in there. And so you break that up however you want. But with other shows on the networks, I think it varies. You know, your half-hour show really is more like 20 minutes or 22 minutes or so. On a local level, it's about a half-hour locally produced newscast, but 22 minutes of actual content and 8 minutes worth of commercials. And that also varies.
Getting back to role-playing games, today we want to talk about adding depth to your character. We've got a lot to cover here, so like dungeon design, this may be two episodes, this may be one, we'll just see how quickly we move through it. But what we're talking about here specifically is you as a player are sitting there with your character, and you want to make this character a little more interesting to play, a little more complex, and make him more than just Fytor. That this is somebody where there's a lot more material there to work with, there's a lot more going on. So I want to start by defining what we mean by depth. We're talking about a couple things here. We're talking about adding complexity to the character's personality, emotions, and motivations. Now, if you're playing a game where you don't want to take it that seriously, you're just trying to make a character who's just got some stats, you're just going to dive in there, have some fun, and it's not going to get real deep, obviously this is really not going to matter for you. But if you're the sort of person that's looking for more of a complex, compelling story, you want a character that's going to, even as you play them, surprise you, or you don't know where things are going to go next, this is the sort of thing that's going to help you out.
Silly names, silly hats, silly walks.
Yes, exactly. But you know, if you look at
three sillies,
if you look at a real person, there's more to them than what most people put into the average character. And what we're trying to do is kind of narrow that gap between what a real person would look like and what, and I want to be careful with this, but what a real person in that fictional universe would look like. I don't want to say a real person because these are fictional universes and fictional characters with fictional powers. And so it's not a one-to-one thing, but you get my point. But we're also talking about adding complexity to a character's background and then also adding an organic unity to the character's background and personality, meaning that the two have something to do with each other. The personality influences the background influences the personality. Who you are changes the way you handle events, and the way events go for you is going to have an impact on who you are. And then, and this is the part that I think is really neat and has created some of the best characters I've ever played, and also created some of the best characters I've ever seen other people play, is allowing the character to grow and be changed in personal ways by the unfolding events of the game. The redemption, the fall, the changes in taste, the changes in the way you see the world. Just this character is not going to be the same person 10 games in that they were at the start of the game. Let's start off with why bother? Why bother adding depth to the character?
If you're doing more than one session, because you'll get bored really quick. If you don't have any semblance of depth to this guy, after your 4 to 6 hour gaming session is over with, what are you going to do with him? I mean, he's got to have something there.
Well, he's going to have like the magical sword plus whatever and the magical armor plus 7. And all he's got to do is get those boots of plus whatever.
You know what? But even right there, there's your hook.
Yeah.
Besides the fact that they're magical, why does he want those things?
Does it boil down to that old actor's question? What's my motivation? What's my character's motivation?
I think to a certain sense it does.
I think so too.
There's a reason why your character is, why is he doing what he's doing?
Why does he care?
Why is he not an accountant? Why is he not a garbage truck driver?
That's one of the really neat things about RPGs as a hobby, is we talk all the time about the storytelling element, but there's another element to gaming that really comes out in character creation and character execution, which is it teaches you a sense of social empathy. That basically it teaches you how other people in other situations might tick. And it helps you to understand perspectives or understand ideologies or understand people that otherwise might be foreign to you. And this is one of the points I put down here under my little thoughts on why add depth, is it challenges your role-playing skills. It really makes you have to put yourself in somebody else's situation that say, you know what, this has never happened to me, or this is not the kind of person I am, but I wonder if under the right stresses, this kind of person might go this way. And suddenly you start to broaden your perspectives on who people are. And suddenly, and you can even see this kind of impacting your real life, because suddenly it becomes a little bit easier to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and understand why they're doing the things they're doing.
On one of our past episodes, we talked about adding depth and flavor to NPCs. Do you guys think that any of that advice can apply? Because I really don't. Because I remember some of the advice was make them a little larger than life, make them stand out. One of the pieces of advice is play up stereotypes, because you can think of them quick off the top of your head. And
I think
not offensive stereotypes, right, necessarily.
Well, I think some of that's going to be useful here. Some of it's not, because ultimately, unless an NPC is a major recurring character, a player character should always be deeper than a non-player character. Mm. Because all I need to do with the barkeep is make him memorable and entertaining. Mm-hmm. Your character needs to be more than just memorable and entertaining, because you're coming back to him minute after minute, second after second, hour after hour, game after game, and you need something there to keep compelling you, to keep challenging you. But I do think there's a couple things that are going to be true there. If you think about it, the purpose of having a colorful NPC is to keep the player engaged. The purpose of having a deep and complex player character is to keep the player engaged.
Right.
And sometimes this will even keep the other players engaged, because if you're playing a really deep, interesting character, what you're doing is going to spill over to other people. As you're sitting there thinking through, man, why would I do this, or what would he do in this situation? The guy next to you is going to kind of start following suit a lot of times. Or even if that doesn't happen, you might see the game go in an unexpected direction, because you're like, you know what? At the start of the game, I was real gung-ho, but then three games in, I kind of saw the result of some of that violence, and now I'm a little more gun-shy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not going to pull my gun. I'm going to find some other way to resolve this. And all of a sudden the game goes in these unexpected directions. It's not just the game master who's unfolding the story, who's dropping the bombs anymore, but now everybody at the table's doing it.
Yeah.
All right. So where do you start? Let's say that you're sitting down to create a character and you've decided that you want to put some depth into this character. I mean, obviously you're going to start the same way you would any other character. You're going to pick a basic concept. You have to pick somewhere to begin. Could be personality, archetype, background, race, class, whatever. You've got to decide, you know, there's some starting point where you say, man, I'd love to play a character like this. I want to.
Should you start with the basics, or should you start with something more complex? And what I mean by that is, should you start with race, attributes, age, height, weight, and build from there? Or should you start with, my parents were murdered in an alley, forcing me into a life of vigilantism?
I think it varies depending upon the day and the weather. You could start with a concept saying, I would love to play a guy that does X. I would love to try a character that does Y. Or you don't even have a concept. You roll some dice and you let the numbers that are generated light some fires in your brain. One of the funnest characters I ever played a long time ago, and this is not a gaming story, was a guy who had very, very average stats.
That's a gaming story.
But what it did was, though, I had no concept for this character, but I looked, I saw he had nothing but average stats. So I'm like, okay, so this guy's motivation is he tries really, really hard to be really, really good at anything he does, but he's ultimately always going to fail. But because of that, he still has a very, very positive attitude.
I would think he would only fail 50% of the time.
Well, you know, I think, though, he's on to something that's a really simple. I've got further down in here ideas on how to help you add complexity to the character. Yeah. But I think one of the neat things that he's bringing out here is actually a point that I've mentioned in past shows, but I didn't have my list here, which is sometimes you can let character creation drive the complexity. One of the most fun exercises you can do is roll your D&D character straight down in stats, then pick the class. That you don't start off with, I'm going to be the mage and I'm going to roll my 6 attributes and then put the 18 in intelligence, but you roll straight down and you take a look at those stats and you're like, man, what is this guy?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden now a character starts coming out that maybe you didn't expect. And because you didn't expect it, you're already pushed out of your normal ruts. And you're going a different direction.
Now, Chad, so you're saying it's better to roll up a character than like a point buy system?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's a possibility for getting you started.
It's one of the advantages of it.
Yeah, it's just a fun exercise. But to your point about, is it better to start with complexity or simplicity? Truth be told, I think you can crack this nut from either direction. There have been times I've sat down and made great characters when I just said, okay, what's the party lacking? And somebody says they're lacking the mage. I'm like, okay, I'll play a mage. But I dedicate myself. I make the conscious choice that this is going to be a deep mage. And I've gone the other way around where I'm sitting there like, man, I just read this biography of some guy who's really interesting. And I'd love to play somebody who's been through these complicated situations. And I try to apply that to the game world. And same thing, you know, sometimes it fails miserably, but sometimes it comes out with some really cool characters. And I think if you have made the dedicated choice that you're going to add complexity to this character, you can start anywhere and end up with a really neat character.
You want to know how I think that is one of the best ways to add spice and interesting things to your character.
How's that, Chad?
Pat, it is by getting other players involved in the character creation process. And what I mean by that is to actually let other people around the table, including the game master, and this requires trust.
You can't trust him.
Is to let
you read
them
my
have...
mind, by the way, because I was waiting for the opportunity to jump in there and say, you can't trust your players to help you create your character because they'll try and screw you over. But
yes,
go ahead.
Totally. And I don't just mean, hey, wouldn't this be cool? Hey, wouldn't that be cool? And that's fine, too. But to say, okay, Pat, I'm playing this. Give me this aspect about him. Mm-hmm. You know, give me, does he have a phobia? Does he have a fear? Does he have this? Does he have that? You decide.
Uh-huh. Or even...
And I'll throw it out if I want to. But and this is what the concept of that Magic, the Gathering system that we have,
yeah,
which is a real, you know, game of Calvin Ball because we change it every time mm-hmm. we do it, which is fun in and of itself. It's an interpretive thing. And we've explained it before. You have magic cards, and then you pull out the magic cards off the thing. You pick them from a pile, and you say, this picture reminds me of this part of the character, or maybe this title means this. And you interpret with broad strokes,
mm-hmm.
very broad strokes. And the cool thing about it is that you pull out cards for your character, and then you pick cards for other people's character that they can interpret. And then you take, you know, people can give you cards, and then you take cards from your hand because you have like five cards or whatever. And you move, and it's like there's rules like everybody take one card from your hand and pass it to the right, and that sort of thing, or pass it across, or you know, pick somebody else.
Getting
else's.
Back to your original comment, I think
I don't even remember what that was.
Your point about letting somebody else write traits for you,
mm-hmm.
I would say try it even more broadly than that. Just go to the guy to your right and say, I want you to write on a piece of paper a personality trait and a background event.
Yeah.
And at this point, they know nothing about your character. They don't know anything, or maybe they know the barest minimum. But just say, I want you to write down one personality trait and one background event,
mm-hmm.
or two personality traits, whatever you want to do. And when they hand it to you, you say, I'm going to incorporate these somehow. And he passes back to you. I mean, it might be a phobia. It might be a love. It might be a passion. It mm-hmm. might be a dream. It might be who knows what. But
that was the coolest thing at Fear the Con. When I played the game, I described it as the Jenga game. It's by the same people who make Don't Rest Your Head and Don't Lose Your Mind. And the game is called Dread the Last Hurrah. Or it's called Dread, and I think he called his campaign The Last Hurrah. Maybe it's called Dread the Last Hurrah. Anyway, this Dread game was so cool. I mean, it was a diceless game, and it didn't have character sheets and stuff. But he passed around character surveys where it asked you questions, but the questions presupposed you knew things about the character that you didn't, and you had to fill in those blanks. It would ask you, why does your character hate his current job? Which, you don't know what his character's job is. You don't know why he hates it.
You don't know that he does hate it.
He does it. And so, but the presupposition is that he has a job that he doesn't like. And you have to answer that. You have to fill that in. I have honestly have to say, I have never been forced to think so deeply about a character in such a short amount of time.
And that's the type of thing
that was awesome.
Even just passing index cards around could do is if Pat passes me a card, says he hates his job. I'm left with the same questions of what's his job? And I didn't know he hated it.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I suddenly have to incorporate that. You know, I think you can do, we talked about the magic cards.
Mm-hmm.
I've mentioned many times there's the random trait thing in the D&D 3rd edition book. It's on page 150 for anyone that cares.
I care.
That's a fun one to play with. But something else I thought of is, you know, you could take a reference book.
Yeah.
You could grab an encyclopedia, or you could look at Wikipedia's chosen entry of the day.
Who owns encyclopedias anymore?
I
know your parents.
My parents have several sets.
Several sets, yeah.
But go to Wikipedia, look at their entry of the day, or I think they even have a surprise me link or whatever.
They have like a random.
Yeah. Pull up a random article and whatever you see there.
Ebola. Great.
Well, you know what?
Yeah.
My character had a debilitating childhood sickness.
Yeah.
Like you
those things
figure out some way to integrate it.
It's like the magic cards or any random concept where you're getting hit with concepts that you don't choose.
Mm-hmm.
The key, I think, so that you still have some control of it, so you get what you want. So it's not just this random jumble of mess. You interpret it with a broad brushstroke. And like, you can even look at a picture and you can interpret the picture. It's like, there's a man sitting in a lotus position on the magic card. Well, does that mean your guy is some yogi or Buddhist or whatever? It's like, well, no, you're kind of making a fighter who's all bloodthirsty. And then you could say he had a teacher who was, and you, we'd say is kung fu, you know, he had this blind teacher who was a yogi and who was killed and he's out for revenge, you know, whatever. You can interpret things off there. Maybe he has, there are moments of calm, or he is trying to calm his inner rage for X, Y, and Z.
And that's one of the things that's both great and you got to be a little careful with in this, is that, as you said, Chad, what you're picking up is ultimately kind of a Rorschach test,
right,
of what do you see in the sync plot. But one thing you have to be careful not to do
is trust your players.
No, is let that put you back in the same ruts.
Yeah.
For example, if you always play a character that's out for revenge and you take a look at that picture of the guy in the lowest position, you're like, he knew someone that could do the lotus position. He's dead, so now he's out for revenge.
Yeah.
Is you have to be careful not to be so locked into your own ruts that you do something like that.
You come to the table and you do these things with the intention of you want to do something different, or you want to get ideas and you want to do something new and interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how these exercises and really
that's
help.
One of the thoughts that I wrote down here was, I think what you ought to do is, you're developing your character, and maybe even before you have him fully fleshed out, is just grab a piece of paper and start kind of writing down the personality traits that you have in mind. You know, he misses his wife, he loves animals, he's afraid of rejection, he's trying to see the best in it, whatever. And start to look at the list, and if the list looks too cheesy, or it looks too short, or it looks too much like the characters you already play, mm-hmm. that's your sign right there. You need to do something. You need to drop something. You need to go to the guy to your left and say, hey, write me two random personality traits. You need whatever. But you can catch this in the very early stages of development if you just do a little bit of internal due diligence to just kind of see, where am I headed with this?
Mm-hmm.
2 points. One, Chad, I think the it should be emphasized again, the idea of when you do exercises like this, to look at them broadly. Because mm-hmm. for the literal-minded of us listening, myself included, that exercise with the cards would be difficult for me to do at the outset, because I'd be looking too literally at the picture and what's going on, rather than abstracting, which is what you should be doing.
Right.
And that's really an important thing to remind people, is that yes, it's got to be broad. And it has to be broad, because you haven't played this guy. You haven't played this character. You don't really know what he's going to turn out to be like. And the other thing is, once you get all these things down, avoid the urge/rush to try and get all these personality traits out right away and start playing them. Because I think you'll end up frustrated and unhappy with the process you just went through, and it'll leave a bad taste in your mouth. Some of those traits you have may not come out right away. Some of them might be until, you know, a couple sessions down the road. But be patient with it and learn to let the actions of the game help to draw those out, and don't feel compelled to throw them all out on the table right away.
Yes, Chris, you're absolutely right. In fact, as I was working all this out in my head, I came up with a couple potential pitfalls, and you just hit one of them right on, which is, don't bite off more than you can chew. Don't make a character that's too much for you to play. If every time the GM says, what are you doing, it takes you 5 minutes, a slide rule and a copy of the DSM-4.
Yeah, and if you haven't read Nietzsche, then you will just not understand my character.
Yeah,
it's a little too much.
It's too much. Don't make a character that's so foreign, because I think it's important here to stretch yourself, to try new things, to try new ideas, to try putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, but don't make something so foreign you can't relate to him at all. Because ultimately,
what if you're playing something so foreign that you can't relate to them?
I think you shouldn't. I mean,
well, and that's the old argument of, can anyone really play an elf? Can anyone really play an insect man or an alien?
Even if today, right now, as we're doing this podcast,
there are alien elves out there.
A gray alien was to walk in and sit down in the chair across from me. Ultimately, what do I understand about that alien? Well,
that he wants to stick something up your butt.
My experience is up. It's the phrase I used to use all the time, is you see the world through the fishbowl of your own eyes. Mm-hmm. That you have to be able to relate to these things somehow. And so don't play something you can't relate to at all. And also, don't make a character so complex that you can't remember him from session to session. Particularly if there's a break of a week or two, that suddenly you can't remember what this guy's like or where he was at in his personal growth. If it's that complicated, you've probably gone overboard to an opposite extreme. Let's talk about background a little bit. As I was thinking about background, lots of things happen to people, but only two things that I could think of really shape who we are, which is number one, significant emotional events, major traumas. Your mom dies. Well, I say traumas. It doesn't be traumas. It could be good. You've lived a life all alone, and finally somebody reaches out to you. But there's an event that is so significant and emotional that it's going to forever change the course of your life and the way you view the world. And the second is persistent events.
Now, see, back to that, the one major one,
yeah.
I could see that as a downfall as well. Because that one thing that happened, I mean, Batman, let's be honest, not a very good character.
No, he's not.
He's neat to watch him do his thing, but when you look at his thing, you know, it's like, I'm Batman. Damn it, you don't understand me. My parents were killed. My parents were killed. My parents were killed. It's like, yes, okay, tragic, we know, and lots of people's parents die. They don't dress up in rubber and run around the street with a little boy solving mysteries. We call those people perverts.
Well, no, and
I agree with you.
That as I lay these out, I want to stress that with the background stuff, just like personality, you ought to sketch out a list of these events. And that same thing, if the list of events in his background are too short, are too cliche, are too, this one event has driven everything that I am, like Batman, you've probably got a bad character on your hands.
You don't think that you can have a minimalist character. And I mean that in not the let's get out of doing work minimalist, but I mean that in the haiku minimalist, the art style of minimalism, the film style of minimalism.
Well, I think you can, but I think you need to be careful. That you need to be careful that minimalism does not be the same as cliche.
Well, I think people also, they say minimalism, but the word they're actually trying to say is poignant. And I think that, how do you make a poignant character? How do you make a character that doesn't have this big, complex background is maybe a simple person, but is deeply interesting?
Well, let me finish the thought I had, okay, and then I'll answer your question, which is I came up with two types of events that I think need to be noted in a background. One is, as I said, significant or major emotional events, but the second is persistent events. For example, you're always around this one friend. Now, this person is not maybe at any point in your life doing anything major, but their way of doing things, their way of thinking over time is going to change the way you view the world. It's going to slowly adjust who you are. Now, to your question, mm-hmm, of how do you make a character that's very minimal, yet is still interesting to play, Pat, what do you think?
I sort of have leaned toward those because, you know, I went through the whole period of time where I had the, you know, the tragic figure, the tragic background or whatever like that, or something like that. And to me, it began to get a little bit cliched. So I started, you know, I have a couple times made characters that, you know, this guy, his parents are alive. Mm-hmm. He goes and sees them on the weekend. He's relatively well balanced. Now, he might have some other, you know, when you do that, though, you do have to come up with some other kind of a motivation. I think it is difficult. But what I think that it allows you to do, though, is to stretch yourself as a role player. And I agree with, you know, a lot of the points that you said here and the fact that all of this is really about sort of growing as mm-hmm. a role player and you know, in your character development and that sort of a thing. So I think that is just another way of doing it. I think it's easier if you've got some of these defining tragedies or joys in the background to build off of. It's harder if you're more middle of the road or so to speak.
I've seen some of the most, what I would define as poignant characters I've seen, actually have more to do with the group than the character. And what I mean by that is everybody in the group makes a character whose parents have died or they're out for revenge, or this person is a zany mad scientist, or this person is a multi-millionaire, or this person is the general of an army. And then you have one guy whose parents are alive, and he's working a job, and he's happy, but he gets mixed up with these larger-than-life people. And he keeps up with them because his being played is so interesting. And because he is... is such a juxtaposition from these larger than life characters that the person playing him plays him so well and with such gusto that he isn't overshadowed by the epic stories or the epic characters. And that he himself, the very fact that this guy isn't loony and crazy, is all the more interesting. It's like there's a movie and a manga and an anime called Ghost in the Shell. And one of the characters, it's like all the characters, one's a full conversion cyborg, you know, and she leaps from building to building, she leaves craters in building because she weighs like 500 pounds because she's all made of metal. And one guy, he's like the gun guy, and one guy's the super hacker, and one guy has all these other cybernetics, and all these characters and backgrounds and histories with each other. And they bring in one guy who has no cybernetics. He was recruited out of the police force. Wasn't some super cop. He was a normal cop, you know, a good cop and an interesting guy. I think he had a family. I think he had a wife and he think he had all this. And they recruit him into this elite agency. And he's asking them, like, why you guys are so wonderful and crazy and stuff. Why me? Why did you pick me? And the main character is basically like, because we're so crazy and out there. If you have an organization that is all the same and all it's all homogenized, which means that they're all cybernetic and they're all like this and they're all combat and they all don't have personal lives and all this sort of stuff, then that group gets boring and predictable and makes mistakes. And we pulled you in precisely because you don't have all the stuff that we have. And you have something that we don't. You're normal.
Well, and I think there's a neat point there, which is sometimes you can even give the appearance of complexity to a character simply by the diversity of the group.
Right.
Now, you can have diversity to a point that the group template falls apart and the group implodes or falls into
extremes to everything.
Yeah, extremes to everything. But if you go around the table and say, you know what, I'm going to play a character who's a pacifist, but the guy next to you is playing the raging bloodlust guy.
In the game we just rolled up characters for, that where you missed character creation, my character, total pacifist, will not raise a finger to harm anyone. Dave's character, assassin in a murder cult.
See, this would bring us right into the next point, which is whether you choose to start with personality or background is ultimately, to me, inconsequential. Mm-hmm. But I think one thing you have to do to create internal consistency in the character and to make that deep role-playing work is you have to remember that cause has effect, that the background and personality are tied together. Okay. Now in the nature versus nurture debate, I'm a believer in both, so I can accept both, but the fact is that
people aren't horses.
Yeah. Well, some portion of that is going to be your nurture. The way you behave, your personality is going to create background, and background is going to create personality. Now, but one thing I would like to stress that people consider is that the effect of events are going to vary from person to person. For example, the loss of a loved one, the loss of your wife. Does this drive you into depression? Does this make you angry at whatever force, be it a personal or impersonal force, took her from you? Does this drive you to new levels of hope? Does this drive you to seek religion? Are you the sort of person where you have a emotional dysfunction to where you don't respond to it at all? And it's this ticking time bomb deep down inside of you that you don't have to go with the obvious response, but you should try to look for this organic marriage between your personality and background, that there in turn, one is causing the other, that your personality causes you to do things and the things that happen to you cause changes within your personality.
That's very true, by the way. One of the things I've noticed working in the news business is that, in general, though reporters are nice people, they're some of the most cynical people I've ever met. And, of course, the reason is for that is because they see the worst of humanity on a daily basis. there's so much that they encounter that doesn't, you know, get dispensed to the general public. Mm-hmm. You can't help but become that way, and so thus in turn, a reporter character is going to develop coping strategies to not necessarily feel a lot of emotion when stuff like that happens, or become very judgmental in certain mm-hmm. aspects. Like what you say, your experiences do motivate and affect your personality.
Something else I jotted down, and I don't want to overstress this because I think it can be misinterpreted, but consider weakness as a source of depth. Now, that doesn't mean I think everyone needs to play the total gimp character. And I understand a lot of people play role-playing games because they want to be something super normal or whatever, mm-hmm. and that's fine. But one thing that adding in some weakness does, presuming you're not using this just as a men to get...
That was not what you thought it was, yeah. I swear to God. Oh, no, it wasn't.
Oh my God.
Gosh damn it.
God, that was a B-flat, I think.
That was awesome.
I could go on and give you the explanation of what
really
happened. You guys ain't going to believe me anyway.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I'm curious. Right. Was it the chair or was it your ass?
No, it wasn't the chair.
It was your ass, wasn't it?
No, yeah. It was not my ass. No, it was. Forget it. You know what? It's even funny with Stephen Try. Dan, I'm sorry to have interrupted your incredible thought here, so please.
But... assuming you're not doing this just to buy some pointless min to get a max, that you're not doing this just to tweak your character, one of the great things about weakness is it keeps you from focusing too much on the power. It keeps you basically saying, okay, my character's not all perfect. There's something wrong with him. And you have to start thinking about how did this happen? What's he doing to overcome it? What kinds of coping strategies does he come up with? And so I think that sometimes just by introducing a weakness into your character, you can force yourself to think a little more about complexity. And I don't think you have to do that, but it is one interesting way. Another one I came up with, and I kind of mentioned this before with people dealing with things in different ways, is sometimes contradictions the source of depth. For example, you can take a look at a situation in your life and say, well, most people would have responded this way, but something made him respond differently. For example, you're playing D&D, you're playing a barbarian, and a gnoll tribe comes in and wipes out all of his village except him because he was hiding in the woods. Well, the typical barbarian character, that means he hates gnolls and he's out for revenge and whatever. But actually what this has given you is a curiosity about gnolls and a desire to understand them, or maybe a, hey, violence doesn't solve anything sort of attitude, that you can take these contradictions. And that right there may get you thinking, okay, what kind of person is this now? And what's making him
tick? He's a dirty gnoll lover. That's what he is.
All gnoll lovers are dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're dirty creatures.
We mentioned looking in nonfiction for a source of inspiration. You can look in history, look at people you know for inspiration, for ideas. I'm not saying play somebody you know, but you can say, you know what, there's this really interesting thing that happened.
Why not?
Well, I guess you could. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that's not necessarily what I'm saying. I'm not saying you have to take somebody whole cloth, mm-hmm. but you could say, you know, there's this really interesting thing that happened to my grandpa. I'm going to write that into my background, mm-hmm. or I'm going to take some trait of this aunt that I know, and I'm going to write that into my character's personality. I mean, I guess you could try and whole cloth play somebody else, but it'd be hard not to caricature them.
I don't know. There are a handful of people in my life that I consider, well, larger than life. My grandfather-in-law, my wife's grandfather on my mother's side. I mean, this dude was a larger-than-life character. I might have told a couple of stories about him, you know, World War II naval veteran, that sort of thing. And, you know, I'm down in his basement, and he's like, hey, you want to see something cool? And I was like, yeah. And he pulls out these two arrows that were Robin Hood, that were one arrow was sticking out of the back of another arrow. And he's like, yeah, I did this at so many feet and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, wow, that's really cool. That is awesome. I can never do something like this. And I was like, oh, you think that's cool? Here, check this out. And he pulls out another. You know, and there's all kinds of stories. It's a guy who has tons of stories like that. I mean, you want to find interesting people? Look at your elders. Look at your grandparents. I mean, of course, there's somebody out there who would be like, my grandfather's a bastard who beat me. And it's like, well, okay, maybe not that guy. But, you know.
Well, even then, he may not be admirable, but.
Might be an interesting character.
What makes somebody like that?
Yeah. And, you know, it's like I could take this grandfather-in-law and spin so many different kinds of characters just on the stories I've heard from him. I can't really do that with my grandparents because I didn't really know them, but that's beside the point.
A couple tips to consider. Consider taking character notes, and this is on both character creation and character execution. When you create the character, what you might want to do is write down, and don't make yourself a 10-page character write-up, because the problem is you're not going to be able to remember most of that and apply most of it to the game. But if you can jot down a couple little notes about his personality or background that are the real big things, the traits that come up again and again and again.
I know, man. I think there's a lot of people out there who write pages and pages and pages on their character.
Well, they do, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I would suggest that in addition to that, jot some cliff notes or bullet points that you can use at the start of the game, have that moment of zen, read these cliff notes and say, okay, this is the guy I'm playing. Never show them
to your game master, because your game master does not trust you.
That's right.
And he will use these notes against you.
He will create a boat phobia trap.
Indeed.
He will then force you as a player then to cheat and cause more distrust around the team.
That's correct. But also,
I'm going down a bad road here.
As your character grows, same thing. Jot down little notes that if he's hellbent on violence, but somebody reaches out to him in compassion and you think that might really get through to him, mm-hmm. Jot down a little note that he's starting to think this kind of direction. There's also some little stuff you can look at, and these are things that may not be part of personality or background, but may point to you've got a rut or comfort zone. Look at the little stuff. Do you always play the same character class? Do you always play the same role within the party? I'm always the guardian, regardless of which class I'm playing. Do your characters always look the same? Are they always about the same age? You can start looking at all these kind of ancillary traits of the character, and those may point out ruts as well.
Is there, and I think that we've talked about this before at this point, is there really a problem with playing the same kind of character over and over again?
Maybe. And I say maybe because I think if you're enjoying it, and that's really what you want out of role playing,
you're always playing the thiefy, sneaky guy,
I guess,
no matter what.
To me personally, I'd say you're not challenging yourself. You're not growing. You are cheating yourself out of possible new experiences. It's like only watching one movie.
Well, on the other hand, there are people who play a single campaign that's lasted 30 years with the same characters.
Right. Yeah, I was...
Isn't that basically the same thing?
It is. I think there's nothing wrong with it, because it is, like you said, it's all about...
There's a law.
It's your experience with role-playing. I mean, it's you playing in the game. I think what you're trying to say is it fair to the group? I think the answer is it's fine.
Yeah.
If that's what that person is comfortable doing, and that's what they really enjoy to do, great. On the other hand, if they want to try something different, then it's certainly encouraged. But as far as it okay? Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I
think they should grow.
New
continuously
and
endeavor
new
to
and
to try something new, just to try to grow as a role player, mm-hmm. to try to improve. God knows I need to.
I've been in groups.
Actually, Pat, I think you're an absolutely fantastic role player. I'm not saying that just to kiss your ass, because I can do that in other ways.
I can't wait.
I've been in groups with the guy that always plays the same character over and over, and typically for some reason it's always the sneaky thief.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say there have been times where it's been detracting from the game because it becomes an agitation to the other players.
Well, that's because he's the sneaky thief guy. If he were playing the wise all-knowing guy, I don't think it would be an
well
maybe.
I can also see a potential problem in the group setting would be, okay, you get somebody else in that says, you know what, I want to try a sneaky thief now, and this guy's like, duh, you can't do that. That's my character.
Why can't we have two sneaky thieves?
It's like,
because you're stealing my
thunder.
It's mine.
You know, that could be that could be a problem. But it's case by case.
All right, let me wrap this up with
an anecdote.
No, a related
gaming story.
No,
a quote from a famous historian.
No, a related question, which is, what if you're the only one at the table bothering to play a deep character? Is it a problem?
Leave the group.
No, I don't think it's...
In Missouri, it's cause for lethal self-defense.
That's true. We take our gaming very seriously here in Missouri.
The Castle Doctrine's like the Frank Castle Doctrine.
I feel another Code Red coming on.
I don't think it is, because from my perspective, I mean, as long as nobody's getting annoyed.
Right.
I mean, it's just like a power gamer shows up to a deep role-playing, you know, all RP session. As long as he isn't annoying anybody, it's fine. Well, same thing. You've got your actor guy showing up to the dungeon crawl. As long as nobody's getting pissed off about it, I think it's fine. But I think it's good because that's my style of role-playing. I like playing deep characters, not boring, stodgy characters, but characters that have depth and are interesting to play, and I role-play, and I act out, and I talk with my hands, whether I'm in character or not. Mm-hmm. And I think that if I could kind of start working that in, and maybe in just some small little ways, get the other players into that and get them to start doing that and kind of turning them towards that, I think that's fun because, you know what? I've done it before.
Yeah, well, I guess what I would say to that is I think the goal for most people, and this isn't always possible because where you are, there may be a very limited number of role players. There may be really limited options, but over time, you ought to try and find a group that wants similar things out of the game as you. If you're into dungeon crawls or power gaming or deep RP or politics or whatever, you ought to try and find a gaming group that's into the same things you are.
That and sometimes it, that's just not
sometimes it's not possible.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know,
niche market.
You have to just kind of accept that you're the only one at the table who's enjoying this aspect of gaming and nobody else is. And I would hope that if you're with friends, at least they would be willing to kind of rotate things a little bit. That, okay, for Bob's sake, we're going to do a dungeon crawl, but now for Joe's sake, we're going to do a deeper game. And, well, you know, if you've got to, cut them a little bit short or something, but at least try and indulge everyone a little bit.
March on and fight the good fight, but don't give up your deep role-playing just because everyone else wants to just kill things.
You know, I always end these shows the same way with saying already, thank you guys for tuning in. We'll catch you next time. So today I'm going to differently and just say, Chris,
what?
Mute the mic when you fart.
I wasn't. I swear to God, it was not a fart.
Okay, I don't think so.
I got
to
hear this.
Comedy gold.
I think there's a lot of other people who want to hear, Chris, what's your explanation?
Here we go.
The explanation is, where I'm recording, it's very warm because it was very warm today. And my little recording setup, I have a
lot of hot air down there.
There's a lot of hot air. And I have two underneath my table where all my equipment is set up here for recording. There are two large cardboard boxes. And the only way I can stretch my legs out is if I stack my one leg on top of the other in between these two boxes. Well, because I'm sweating as I'm recording this,
you're just digging a deeper hole.
As I pull the leg out, the sweat rubs against the cardboard, and it does make that noise. It did it earlier, too. It just wasn't as loud that time.
I will tell you guys, I believe Chris. And the reason I believe Chris is because Chris is a man who is proud of his gas.
If I do it, I'll own up to it.
Yep. If he lets one loose, he will announce it.
All right. Well, I said I was going to end this episode the same way, so Chad, just say see ya, and we'll go to the copyright notice.
See ya!
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.